you piece of trash! You stupid piece of trash! Happy Halloween!
Hi, I'm Leela Runowitz, and this is I'm Deep Throat Podcast. This is episode 15, and I decided to do something special for the Halloween season since I love Halloween so much. So this episode is actually a fictional horror story that I wrote. I know I'm putting it out kind of late because I took a long time like dicking around with like the editing and writing and shit like that, so it's a little bit late, but I hope you enjoy it. It's fucked up, it's violent and discusses a lot of horrible shit, like murder and abuse and all kinds of crap. So don't say I didn't warn you that it's fucked up, but it's you know, it's fun and Halloween and all that shit. Anyways, I now have a PayPal link, since some people have asked me about it, and that is PayPal.me/I'mDeepThroat, and you can donate to that link if you want to. Thank you very much. Link is in my podcast description. Happy Halloween, and I hope you enjoy.
Replay this.
He came into her life so suddenly that looking back at it all, Melanie couldn't help but think that it truly was a type of destiny that brought them together. They only knew each other for a very brief time, 4 months, and yet the rest of her life carried his essence. She wore the stain of him forever. If she was honest with herself, she would admit that from the beginning, some part of her knew this, yet she had no way of knowing how deep and how dark that stain would be. The night they first spoke was a Saturday in October. It was typically busy for a weekend on the phone sex line. After 6 p.m., the frantic slide towards desire began to ratchet up. The calls began as casual, exploratory. men who found themselves alone in big houses, in hotel rooms, in one-bedroom apartments shared with absent partners, men for whom the descending autumn darkness brought on a stirring, called in. Languidly, with a sense of leisure that is only afforded to a rare few, but that many imitate sincerely, they let their fingers pull the end of their credit card from their wallets. They would hold the small piece of plastic with its corners rounded like the surface of a toddler's toy as they punched in the numbers on it, which were raised like Braille. There was, of course, a dizzying array of women to select from, with names as pedestrian as Linda and as lofty as Aphrodite. If you scrolled fast enough through the profiles, it was like seeing your own life flash before your eyes, with every mistake and triumph you ever fucked. There were heavily airbrushed pictures that likely only held the scarcest memory of the original subject's likeness, and there were jarring photos of profoundly unkempt women who wore neither makeup nor any expression more pleasant than a scowl. These profiles in particular were genuinely very popular. There was everything in between, self-conscious pictures of women in their 20s pursing their lips in an effort to look pouty and provocative, usually taken from an awkwardly high angle that they were certain concealed every physical flaw they had. There were pictures of women with cheap hair extensions and too much eye makeup who were likely still the bane of their parents' existence. There were the blatantly stolen photos of penthouse models and obscure beauty queens who, though clearly of North American origin, seemed to have trouble with basic English writing skills, as evidenced by the descriptions on their profiles promising, "Hot sex is time for you, baby, yeah, come on now." Cosplayers in colorful wigs with unnaturally big eyes were the fad of the moment on the phone sex line. Tiny women helped climax the callers with the most suspect of desires by pretending to be underage anime characters, cooing and crying in dog whistle voices about tentacle monster penetration. Melanie's favorite photos were the most absurd, the ones of heavy-set, menopausal women with pendulous stomachs and drooping breasts, squinting into the camera under the harshest of lights, with every wrinkle and fold on their naked bodies as visible as if they were sketched by hand in a life drawing class. These profiles typically offered the perverted mommy experience of scolding, spankings, humiliation, and no-nonsense handjobs. Akiko was a Japanese woman, probably in her 40s, who took photos in schoolgirl outfits of her holding her kilt up to reveal pristine white panties. The promise of her profile was that you could pay her to piss in them and then take them off to put on her face while she cried and masturbated for you. Pictures and video could be provided at extra cost. There was also a profile of a woman who called herself Gigi Hadid, though the photos proved that she was actually a heavily tattooed brunette who only provided callers the opportunity to call her so she could ignore them for hours on end. This is a very popular fetish. Melanie was a generalist. When she had joined the service 6 months previous, she had been given three profiles featuring photos of women who were not her. One was of a dominatrix named Rain, who was muscular to the point of nearly being a bodybuilder. She received a lot of calls from elderly wrestling fanatics who wanted her to body slam their frail bodies and worship her oiled muscles. Another was a college-age Asian girl named Cindy who wore bunny ears in every photo. The third was Rochelle, who looked like she could be 25 to 35 despite being an obvious tanning fanatic. As the hours fell into one another and alcohol, drugs, unfulfilled yearning, and churning unleashed testosterone filled systems and opened the cells, callers steadily let the beast off the chain. Insults, screams, boasts, and confessions surged forth until Melanie's ears, mind, and apartment were filled with the essence of pure male id. One caller introduced himself as Mr. Dark. Melanie knew from experience that anyone with a Mr. title on the sex line was bound to be trouble. It took a very lost person to pay to use a self-inflicted nickname like that. "What can I do for you tonight, Mr. Dark?" she asked, stifling laughter. With a heavily affected voice, he responded, "Well, your voice is just so cute. So innocent sounding. I was thinking..." "I don't do underage," Melanie interrupted. After a beat, he spoke again. "Too bad. Such a waste of talent. You sound just like a little..." "Are you fucking deaf?" Melanie said. "I said no, motherfucker." "Okay, okay, I'm sorry. Geez," responded Mr. Dark, in a voice much higher and more nasally than the original vocal offering. After hanging up, Melanie put her phone on her coffee table and stretched, feeling tension pull from her muscles. She stood up and walked to the kitchen across the tiled floor, her sequined slippers making a soft whooshing sound as she moved. Sitting on top of the stove was her latest foray into baking, pumpkin loaf. The earthy, rich smell of cinnamon and ginger scented the air still. She touched the top of the loaf, which still retained a little heat from the oven. Sliding open a drawer, she pulled out a chef's knife, sinking the blade into the soft center, right in the middle of the loaf. She sliced a hefty portion, bringing it to her nose to take in the aroma before tasting it. She wasn't sure if her baking was only good to her, or that her pride was making her believe it was better than it really was, but the density seemed perfect, and the spices weren't overpowering for once. She had a tendency to overdo it in that department. A cool chill stirred the curtains hanging above the sink area. She had forgotten to close the window. Fall was so beautiful that it was easy to forget its ruthless barreling towards cold weather. She pulled the curtains aside to shut the window, checking out her collection of plants congregated on her sill. She could remember the names of none of them, but was pleased that she had miraculously stumbled into some sort of luck regarding keeping them alive. She pressed her palm against the screen, feeling the wind whisper through it and kiss her hand. She could hear cars, wind chimes, voices, dogs barking, leaves scraping the sidewalk and road. The world. Melanie slid the window into place, locking it, and pulled the curtain closed. She sighed, surveying her small apartment. It wasn't fancy, with a typical collection of IKEA mixed with thrift store finds, but it was clean, cozy, and hers. The flames of many scented candles danced and wobbled, throwing shadows all over the little space. It was moments like this when she felt happy, when she felt grateful, when she had tenderness for herself and the simple things and private joys she cultivated for herself. She liked herself in these moments. The darkness seemed to clear, and she saw herself as she maybe really was, struggling but capable of serenity and worthy of kindness from herself. The phone rang, startling her as it frantically shimmied on the surface of the coffee table. She picked it up. It was 12:45. She usually stopped work by 2 a.m., since by then the callers had developed into full-blown masturbatory psychosis, which wasn't worth staying up for. She answered. The next thing she heard was Heidi, the electronic robo-pimp. "You have a new caller request for your profile. Cindy. To accept this call, press..." Melanie pressed 3 with her thumb, and after a second heard, "You are now being connected." "Hello," she said. "Hello," said a man's voice back to her. With just one word, she felt herself shift. "Who is this?" she asked. "My name's Max, and who might you be?" "I'm Cindy. It's nice to meet you, Max." "Nice to meet you, too." His voice was deep, yet smooth. It was hard to guess how old he might be. "And what can I do for you tonight, Max?" "Well," he started, "I imagine that this is an odd request." She braced herself. It could be anything. "Sounds exciting," she said. "That's a matter of opinion, Cindy. See, I just watched this movie tonight. I hadn't never seen it before. Of course, I have no idea if you've seen it, but even if you haven't, I'd really like to discuss it with someone. I can't make heads or tails of it. It's the damnedest thing." Melanie paused. "Is that okay?" he asked. "Of course," she replied. "It's just very unusual, but not in a bad way." "I hope not. It's just a movie, after all." "What movie is it?" "It's called Hereditary. Have you seen it?" Cindy couldn't help snorting. "Yes, I have, Max." "What did you think of it?" I hated it a lot." She could hear Max exhale sharply. "Yeah, okay, good. I thought it was maybe an age thing. I'm probably the oldest caller you've ever had." "I don't know about that. Some callers..." "I'm almost 80, Max interrupted. "Okay, yes, you are the oldest caller for sure. You don't sound that old, though." "I suppose that's a good thing," Max said. "It's the one part of me that hasn't fallen to shit over time." "We all fall to shit, though." "Don't I know it. Anyways, this fellow who works for me, Ben, he's a young guy, and I asked him for some movie recommendations. He's a horror film guy, and he raved about Hereditary, said it was as good as The Exorcist." "I respectfully disagree on that one big time, Ben," said Melanie. "I saw The Exorcist in the theater when it came out. This ain't it." "That's so cool that you got to see it when it was so new," Melanie said. "I heard there were people passing out at the theaters when it came out. It was so scary." Yeah, I think that that may have been a marketing gimmick, but it was very shocking. You got to remember, it was a different time. There weren't as many horror movies out, so seeing a 12-year-old girl stab herself in the crotch with a crucifix was pretty intense. It wasn't an imagery that had been seen in movies until then. I guess so, replied Melanie. It's so easy to forget that, to think about how much things change. When I saw Halloween, the first one, there were women in the theater crying from fear. No way, that's so crazy. Why were they so upset? It was the first slasher movie, I believe, said Max. I think it was their worst fears being realized, seeing young women getting slaughtered. It's easy to not think about it, but when it's a movie, it's confrontational. I think they were terrified but fascinated, which is why they didn't leave despite their reactions. It's so strange to think that violence can become entertainment. No wonder everyone is so desensitized, said Melanie. We're an appalling species at times. Hard to argue with that one, said Melanie. So when did Hereditary lose you? Gosh, within the first 10 minutes. Right away, it was obvious that Grandma was part of some cult and that little retarded girl was some aspect of it, sacrifice, yada yada. I mean, I've seen Rosemary's Baby. This ain't new. Melanie laughed. Right? I mean, just because you like it doesn't mean you need to imitate it so blatantly. I thought it was hilarious that they made sure that the audience knew that the sister was severely allergic to nuts. And then when they were at the party, these girls were furiously chopping walnuts for brownies. Like, oh, I wonder what's going to happen. I've never seen high school girls bake in the middle of a party where everyone is getting drunk and making out. Yeah, replied Max. I was glad to see the kid go, but it felt like a race. Like the director was very pleased with himself, so he couldn't wait to get to it. Pacing be damned. What did you think of the mom, Toni Collette? Oh, the screamer? Could have done without her. People said she should have gotten an Oscar for that role. Standards have slipped, I see, said Max. I mean, loud doesn't mean good acting. Range is a good thing, too. There's so many horror movies now that are like, it's some sort of cult or of normal, everyday kind of people, and they either worship Satan or some really obscure demon that they worship and sacrifice to give them wealth, but they seem to stay in the same, like, modest financial bracket. Yeah, it's a lot of work sacrificing babies not to get a yacht out of it, Max said. I thought the Satan worship stuff fell out of style in the 90s. They continued to talk, laughing easily. Before long, an hour and a half had passed. Well, that's about it for me tonight, said Max. The old man needs to sleep. I feel that, said Melanie. Thank you for talking to me, Cindy. I enjoyed it. I did too. I really did, she said. They said good night and hung up. Melanie signed off. She was tired but excited, electrified by her conversation with Max. The ease with which they settled into each other's company was startling and yet comforting. It felt like she had located an old friend after a long spell of not seeing them, and they picked up just where they had last left off. She felt like she knew him, and like he knew her, like he was waiting for her to find him, even though he had been the one to call her. Before bed, she took a hot bath, submerging her head into the water, leaving her face above the surface, her hair fanned around her like seaweed. With her feet propped up on the tiles above the faucet, she slid her body from one end of the tub to the next. She always called this mermaid slithering. 2 days later, Max called her back. I just couldn't stay away, he told her. He started calling her regularly, not always every day, but when he called, they typically talked for hours. He never moved the conversation to a sexual place, which, though curious, was a relief for Melanie. At first, she assumed his age was the reason for it. She learned that Max had had his own contractor business before retiring, that he had traveled extensively, and that he was terminally ill with prostate cancer. He spent most of his time in a hospital bed installed in his house. Ben was his nurse, who typically left at night at Max's insistence. After he admitted his illness, Melanie promptly burst into tears after they had hung up. She couldn't explain it to herself, why she felt the way that she did. Later, she would know that the idea of the impending death of the one person she had truly connected to in such a long time was what caused it. Knowing the end was certain to something so wonderfully sudden filled her with despair. It had been Ben who had found the phone sex line number for Max on his iPhone, since Max refused to have internet access. But there's so much information right at your fingertips, she told Max. I know too much already. I'm good, said Max. She found herself thinking of Max often, recalling conversations that they had had. Knowing he was going to call gave her a warmth and a comfort in a job that required her to be so steely. She had a genuine fondness for the elderly man. "I know that the pictures of you on the site aren't the real you," said Max the next time they spoke. "I confess, you figured me out, Sherlock. I'm actually a for-real ginger. I don't have neon orange hair, though, more auburn, and I have visible eyebrows and eyelashes. Sounds positively lovely. I do adore a redheaded lady, I confess. I hated it as a kid, but I've grown to appreciate it. I bet your name isn't even really Cindy." "Damn, you're good," said Melanie. "I'm old. I know a thing or two. Don't worry. I still like you, even if you're a big liar, Miss Cindy. Thank you for accepting me. I'll keep your secret. No need to worry on this end," said Max. In between calls from Max, she of course entertained regulars. Roger was a man whose only sexual interest was stripping naked and sitting in a pie while wrapped in a clear shower curtain. "It's key lime today," he told her. "That's a new one. I imagine the filling is refreshing." "Yeah, it's nice. Apple pie is good heated up in the microwave, though." "It's good to have variety," said Melanie. "I don't like key lime, though. Cujo will eat it." "I don't think it's a good idea to let your dog eat pie. You could give him diabetes," said Melanie. "I want him to be happy, though," said Roger. "I wonder what he thinks of what you do to yourself. It must be confusing to him." "He accepts me for who I am. He legit loves me. That's why I want to give him this pie I'm sitting in," said Roger. "Have you ever been married?" she asked Max one night. "Guilty as charged," he responded. "Do you have kids?" "Yep, a daughter, Julie," Max said. "Do you talk to her a lot?" There was a tense, prolonged pause. "No," said Max finally. "That's too bad." "I'm sorry, I shouldn't ask. It's not my business." No, it's... She went missing a long time ago, is the thing. "Oh my God, really? That's awful. I'm so sorry, I can't even imagine." "How old was she?" 20. "You don't have to tell me, but can I ask what happened?" "Sure. I was working at the time, 3 hours outside of the city. My crew and I were remodeling a lake house for this rich couple. They put us up in a hotel so we wouldn't need to commute. On the third day, I went back to the room to crash. That was the last sleep of my life as I once knew it. I woke up to chaos. The lady at the front desk was pounding on the door, saying the police needed to speak to me urgently. At the time, Julie was renting an apartment with this girl named Holly. Julie worked as a waitress at a cocktail lounge, or that's what she had told me. She had a car I gave her for her 16th birthday, and she would usually come home between 2 a.m. and 3 a.m. I worried a lot about her, but she was very independent, very stubborn. Anyways, she didn't come home one night after work, and this was strange for her. Holly thought that maybe she had gone home with a guy she met or drove to my house, something like that. But the next night, she still hadn't seen her, and then her work called her apartment asking about her since she hadn't come in. Holly tried to call everyone else, including me, but I wasn't home. I was at the job site. This was before cell phones, you gotta remember. She called the police and they found me. I hopped into my truck and raced back home. Oh my God, you must have been terrified. I nearly got in an accident on the way home a few times. My mind just raced. I thought that the sooner I got there, the sooner I could find her. Did they have anything to go on other than her being gone? Max swallowed hard before answering. The last time anyone saw her, she was getting into her car after her shift at work. She never came home, as far as anyone knows. So scary. Thinking how someone can just vanish with no trace. That's not entirely applicable to Julie. They did find something shortly after she went missing. What? They did find her car a few days later. That's all they ever ended up finding. It was on this remote road, a few few miles away. It was torched. Holy shit. They told me when they found the car that it had a body in it. I, of course, thought it was her. Who was it? It was a man. Who was he? They never found out. Dental records? They never found any that matched. I was told that if a person hasn't had a dentist in a long time, then usually there's nothing to match. He may have been foreign or illegal, who knows. The car had no license plate on it and had been burnt for about a day or so before they found it. How'd they know it was her car without plates? The VIN number, vehicle identification number, started installing them in this really fail-safe way around 81, so her car had one. That's how they identify most cars, even the really burnt ones. Oh, I didn't know that. I don't know if I should say this, but I found some stuff out about Julie during the investigation. Some stuff I never knew. She wasn't a cocktail waitress. She was an exotic dancer, turns out. You didn't know? No, I mean, in fairness, I know why she hid it. She was afraid I'd be mad at her. And I would have been, honestly. I feel very ashamed of that. Why? Because it very well could have been because of the job that she had, that she got abducted, some sleazy customer, something like that. You can't blame yourself, though, Max. Yeah, I know, but I do. Maybe if I had been easier to talk to, she wouldn't have hidden it. Maybe I blame myself because it's an answer in a situation that doesn't have any. If I blame myself, I can think less about the person who actually did take her. That's pretty twisted, Max. Whoever took her was a bad person. You're not a bad person. It's not your fault. What do you think happened to her? Max was silent. I'm sorry, said Melanie. I shouldn't ask this stuff. I'm sorry. It's rude. No, I do get the curiosity, and it's been a long time since I've talked about her. Sometimes I think I've made peace, but sometimes I think I'm just numb. I can't feel it the same way anymore. I'm too tired. It's all done too much to me. What about her mother? She's gone too. You must miss Julie. Of course. I have a lot of pictures of her. I've looked at them and held them in my hand so much that a lot of them are disintegrating. You should laminate them. Oh, if I had wanted to do that, I'd have done it already. These pictures and my memories are all I have left of her. I know it sounds crazy, but I don't want anything between her and me, not even a plastic casing. We've already been separated by so much time. That's beautiful, Max. I like to arrange them in chronological order, and I go through them slowly, one by one, remembering her life. And then I get to the last one, and after that, she's gone. It's like a song fading out at the end, going someplace else. I guess when I flip through them, it's like I'm replaying her life, letting her be alive again in some way. I wish I could have given her 1,000 lifetimes. There's so many stories of people being found years after they disappear, especially with the internet. Lots of cold cases are being reopened. Oh, I know, but this isn't one of those very rare stories, I'm afraid. No matter how much I wish it was. Even if by some miracle it gets solved, I'll be long gone by then. I told myself for a long time that maybe she had amnesia, maybe she was in another country, that she was trying to get back home. She's been gone since 1988. I've watched decades change into new decades and a new millennium even. At some point, as you watch the world change so much around you, and as time marches on, you know that someone really is gone. I spent a lot of time being sad and angry. I think I got cancer because of it, I really do. I think all that bitterness made me sick. I feel like, I don't know, maybe I beat the odds and have been given borrowed time because she wants me to finally let go. There's no good reason why I'm still here. The doctors say they can't make sense of it, but maybe it's like an act of grace from beyond. After they hung up, Melanie got on a search engine and typed disappearance 1988 torch car. There were very few links that came up after pressing enter. The top search was an ancient news article from a local paper in a small town in Ontario she had never heard of, with the uninspiring title, "Police Still Baffled 2 Years After Mysterious Disappearance of Young Woman." The article, of course, mentioned the burned-out car, the unidentified man, but not much else. There was, however, a picture of a beautiful young woman with long, straight brown hair and a perfectly sculpted little face, and sad eyes with the caption, "Julie Barclay, exotic dancer at Contiki Lounge, last seen 1988. The article also mentioned that her roommate, Holly, had also gone missing not long afterwards. Beyond a few random mentions in cold case forums, that was all. Just another young woman swallowed up and discarded by the wayside of time. It was late on a Thursday night, and Melanie was losing patience. "Hurry up, piss tarp. Jesus. I folded this wrong the last time I put it away," said piss tarp. How do you fuck up something so basic? Like you had one job, asshole. Piss tarp, as the name suggests, was a man who lugged out a large, ugly blue tarp he stole from work to spread out in order to throw his legs up over his head and piss on his own face. He did this in his garage, beside workout equipment that he never used, while his family slept inside his house, unaware. "Okay, I got it," Melanie sighed. "You're naked, yeah?" "Oh yeah, all right, baby. I'm ready too." Just then, through Piss Tarp's phone, Melanie heard the banging sound of a door being opened in a most aggressive way. This was followed by a woman's voice reaching previously unknown registers. "Dan, what the fuck are you?" Followed by Heidi. "This call has concluded. Thank you." Piss Tarp was gone. It was nearly 1 a.m. when Max called. "Hey, how are you doing tonight?" asked Melanie. "Later than usual for you. Can't sleep?" "No," said Max, his voice oddly flat. "What's up?" There was a long pause. "There's something in the backyard," he then said. A chill moved through Melanie at lightning speed. "Something or someone?" "Huh?" he said softly. "Is it an animal, like a coyote or a dog, maybe?" She could hear him breathing, but he didn't respond. "Max, can you hear me?" "Yes, of course I can," he said. "Does it have four legs or two?" "I thought it had four. I watched it move around the backyard. But it saw me in the window, and then it stood up." "So it's a person." After a second, Max responded, "No, it's not." "Then what is it?" "Oh," said Max suddenly. "I know, I remember." "Can you see its face, if it's looking at you?" "It doesn't really have one. Not what you could call a face. It is looking at me, but it doesn't have a face." "Max, where is Ben? Can you call him?" Max ignored her. "Do you have a computer nearby with internet?" "Yeah, of course." "Can you look up something for me, dear?" Melanie pulled her silver laptop down the length of her bed. "Yeah, what?" "Look up, Silverstone Sisters, 1973, Winnipeg." Melanie typed them in. Within seconds, a slew of results lit up her screen. Melanie stared at the screen, her eyes darting wildly as she took in the information while scrolling. "Anything?" asked Max. "Yeah," Melanie said quietly. "Did you know these people or something?" "I sure did. Read it to me, will you? Help a dying old man out." Melanie selected the top search. "Are you sure, Max?" "I think you've maybe had a stroke, or maybe something happened with your medication. I want to help you. Can you tell me where exactly you live?" "You are helping me. I want you to read it, please." Melanie stared at the screen. The rape and murders of sisters Genevieve and Joan Silverstone, along with the deaths of three of their children, Daniel 12, Margaret 9, and Stephen 16, and the abduction of Genevieve's five-year-old daughter, Michelle, were committed the night of March 31st, 1973, in Winnipeg, Manitoba, by an unknown intruder. In that moment, something in Melanie's mind clicked into place, and she was overwhelmed with a sense of sudden, horrifying, yet certain knowing. Max spoke. I'll never forget that night. People say that type of thing is senseless, but that's not true. You have to be there to know it. To do that sort of thing, you let open a door. Everybody hears the knock, not everybody opens it. I did it for her. I crossed over for her. I had to get to her. There's a part of being human that too many ignore, the part where you kill. I thought I wasn't going to do it, but I did. I wanted to, and I think I liked it. There were photos, black and white, of all the victims. Here they were in life, smiling in school pictures, together in Sears portraits, together in candid moments at Thanksgiving, on birthdays. And here they were in death, their eyes open wide, forever seeing their last moments flash before them, their eyes glassy with the reflection of their killer, their teeth clamped onto the gags in their mouths. They were all bound, limbs twisted behind them, their knees pushing them into fetal positions. Three of the victims, the children, were laying on the carpet in the living room, arranged in a sort of semicircle, facing one another. Another body lay on the sofa a few feet from them, a dark-haired woman with her hair splayed around her, her face contorted in a grimace of agony. She seemed to be wearing a long nightgown that was pulled up to her waist. Blood saturated her lower half. A blonde woman lay face down at the bottom of the staircase that led to the living room. She wore only a pajama top. She was the only one with handcuffs on. Under her body was a large circle of blood. Melanie felt like she was about to lose control of her bladder. Her stomach twisted violently into an hourglass, wringing out acid. She planted both feet on the ground and tried to stand up. She immediately felt dizzy, and a sharp pain stabbed her brain like an ice pick. She sat back down on her bed, hard, panting. With the phone still pressed to her ear, she folded the top part of her body over her knees, clutching her stomach. "I think I'm gonna be sick," croaked Melanie. She heard Max softly chuckle. "I suppose that's my fault. Sorry," said Max. "Why are you doing this?" asked Melanie. "I've been waiting for 40 years for the door to get kicked down by the feds, and it never happened. They never caught me. I think you came into my life so I can tell you, right before it ends. Fate." Tears spilled from Melanie's eyes. "You're lying. You're lying to me. I don't know why you're doing this, but you are lying." "Oh, really? 1156 Green Terrace Drive, split level bungalow?" Her insides churned with sickness. "Genevieve was a real looker, wasn't she?" said Max. Genevieve was the blonde. In her living photos, she had silky straight hair framing her face, which was perfectly sculpted. In any time, in any era, she would have turned heads. "Yeah," said Max. "She was dating my buddy, John, at the time. She was a party girl, not super bright, but lucky for me, she had a backup." "What the fuck are you talking about?" asked Melanie. "Can't you see her picture? Michelle, her daughter, spitting image. When I saw her the first time, I had never seen anyone so perfectly made." As soon as Melanie saw the picture of Michelle, a painful jolt of recognition sang through her. Michelle's hair would darken as she grew, but she was to keep the sculpted little face and sad eyes. And of course, her name would change to Julie. John and I were working together in construction. After work, we'd go to get some beers at the local bar. He was dating Jen, who came along fairly often. One day she brought in Michelle. She sat on the stool next to me. Jen ordered her Shirley Temples. That's the drink of choice for the children of alcoholics. Jen ignored her, acted like she was a nuisance. I could tell Michelle was needy. She had no dad, so she liked the attention I gave her. I made sure to get out of the bar before they did. I sat in my car and I waited for them to leave. Then I followed them home. I saw where they lived. I quit the job I had, told everyone I had a new job in Toronto and was moving. Melanie felt helpless as she listened, paralyzed by his words. She knew he wasn't lying, that he could unleash himself upon others at will. I climbed up the side of the house, slid open a window and crawled in, and Jen was asleep. I stood watching her. She looked so beautiful. I stood with my mask and my gloves and my gun. I never felt that way before, like I was going to jump in front of a moving train or off a ledge of a high building. It's amazing she didn't hear me. I glanced out the window and I saw something. I thought it was a dog. I was worried. But then it saw me and stood up. I was scared, but I also knew. I knew that if I did what I was about to do, that my life wouldn't be mine entirely anymore. It would be guided by whatever was out there in the backyard. Do you ever wonder why people get away with bad things? Why serial killers and murderers don't get caught? I think it's because of whatever that thing is. Everyone hears a knocking at one point in their life, when someone hurts you, when someone has something you want, when someone makes you jealous, when the hatred floods you, blinds you. In those moments, you split in half and a decision needs to be made. What door should I open? How far will I go? We hear the knock in those moments. Many don't open the door, but many do. I did a lot of bad things up until then, lots of robbery, lots of assaults, things like that, but I never really answered the knock until that night. I didn't know Jen lived with that ugly sister and those little brats. I slapped the cuffs on her and made her go to each of the rooms and get them out to go down to the living room. I had my rifle on her back the whole time. Luckily, I had brought rope and they had plenty of knives in the kitchen. The gun was loaded, but it was really just for show. I didn't want to use it in case anyone heard the bang. I didn't want to take a risk, even with a pillow to muffle it. The night they died, I told them if they did everything I said, they'd live. I think that they really did believe it. They didn't realize that their big wet eyes and their desperation, their faces all pale with fear, only made me want to kill them even more. They looked like ghouls, like they were already dead. It sealed their fate. And they thought they were saving themselves. I did them a favor. They were average, mediocre. They weren't going to have interesting, daring lives. They were nobodies. And you think you're somebody? I'm everybody. I'm more human than you. I felt more than you ever will. Melanie felt locked together with him. How did you get away with this? And for so long? It was a different time. You could steal IDs easily. You just needed to move around, be careful, be quiet, don't act up. I used the birth certificate of a boy who died as a baby the same year I was born. That's what they call a breeder document. That helped me get my IDs. You could do shit like that then. People really don't pay attention as much as anyone wants to believe. When Michelle first saw me that night, I was in a mask. I shut her bedroom door and left her sitting on her bed. The next time she saw me, they were dead. I had taken off my mask and hurried into her room. I told her a bad man had broken into her home and hurt everyone. I had fought him off, but he was gone, and I was here to rescue her. I picked her up and carried her outside. I told her to cover her eyes as she walked out, but she peeked. I heard her gasp in my arms, which worked in my favor. I told her we had to run to get away from him. I convinced her we needed to live under aliases, not talk about her former life or what happened. It was like a game. We drove around, changing vehicles and staying in lots of hotels under fake names. I told her she always needed to keep the man a secret, because anyone she met might be connected to him. And we did settle eventually. I put her in school and everything. I really think that she forgot or blocked everything out. She always called me Daddy, which actually made things better for me, helped me hide better. You're a sick fuck. I took care of her. I got her up, made her breakfast, made her lunch, got her to school, picked her up, made her dinner, helped her with her homework. We watched movies, ate ice cream. We were normal. I kept waiting for something to happen. I figured I'd get busted, and I never did. But when Julie turned 13, she changed. She became a nightmare, a real little bitch, drinking drugs, fucking boys to make me jealous. I had to yank her out of school. She got knocked up a few times, which I took care of on my dime, even though I wasn't even sure they were mine. I got her a fake ID, and she started working at the strip joint. She made a lot of money, which was good for me because she was such a pain in the ass. You forced her to work there. She couldn't do anything else. I took a lot of risks for her. Anyways, I got her a car, apartment with Holly, who was one of her stripper friends that I banged on the side. But she was a liability. She drank a lot, got in trouble. She was asking me too many questions about the past. She asked me if the bad man was still after us and why I didn't go to the police. I could tell she had grown to hate me. I could see what I had done to her, the way I changed her. You could tell she was really fucked up. I could see the way the people at the club looked at me. Maybe watching your daughter's strip club tipped them off, snarled Melanie. Whatever. I knew it was all done and over. I got the gig working in the lake house, and it was like, all my problems were solved. Who killed Julie? Asked Melanie. This worthless junkie I found on Skid Row. I picked someone not too jumpy. I picked him up a few times to blow me, and I asked him if he wanted to make some money. Of course he did. I gave him Julie's address, and he waited in the bushes beside the parking lot of her building the night he nabbed her. I told him, make sure no one's around, no one in the windows. It'll be dark and super late. Let her get a little ahead of you, then get up behind her and strangle her. Don't give her a chance to scream. If you don't kill her right away, she will fight you. You don't want that. Once she was dead, he put her in the trunk of her own car, switched out the plates, and drove to my place. There was an automatic garage door, so he parked in there. It was very late, but in case the neighbors noticed, they'd just think it was her in the back in the house. He closed the door and put her body wrapped up in plastic in the shed in the backyard. It was cold then, so I knew there was no chance of early decomp. Then he drove away. I told him to lay low for a bit, get out of town, don't let anyone see you. I gave him cash to stay at hotels. I promised him I'd give him all the money a couple days later. We met on the deserted area they found the car in. He had taken off the plates, like I asked. I got out of my truck, and as I got close, I threw a Molotov through the front window. Whoosh! The whole car went up. It was something to see, man. His limbs flailing with fire, his head looked like a screaming skull. I had to get the fuck out of there, though. So, you had an alibi with the lake house job, said Melanie. Yeah, I wasn't gonna do that shit myself. Why not? You destroyed her life. You might as well have been the one to take it. You know, the thing is, I thought seeing her dead wouldn't do anything to me, but it was a shock. As insane as she got, I did raise that little girl. And being her daddy was truly the best years of my life. What, did you just dump her somewhere? Oh, no, she's still here. I put her under the back porch. Are you serious? I hardly think I'd choose to lie now. You killed Holly too, didn't you? There was a startled pause. How'd you figure that one out? Said Max. She must have known it was you. How could she not? It's funny. The police knew my alibi. She was a stripper, and she was an adult, so I don't think that they cared much. If they suspected me, they never had shit to make it stick. But Holly knew. She tried to leave town, but I paid her a visit. Is she under the porch, too? No, I buried her in the woods ages ago. I think that these dead bitches gave me cancer. I kept their secrets, and it rotted me out. Melanie inhaled deep, and on the exhale, she let out a fantastic sob. You don't like me anymore, do you? Max asked. The world flooded before her. Her heart broke over and over in a cycle of renewed pain. You know why you never got caught? She asked through stifled sobs. Because you're dead already. No one suspected you because nobody noticed you. No one bothered to look at you or for you because you've always been just a shadow of a person who wanted to be real. Nah, I don't, Max began to say, then stopped. Wait, that thing in the backyard, I can't see it. There is no thing in the backyard, you crazy old fuck. No, there really... She could hear Max's footsteps falling, sending creaks through the house. There's something... It was quiet for a moment, like a final gasp before a scream. Melanie stopped crying and strained to hear. There was a low hum coming from Max's end, hypnotic and persistent. She could hear him walking, his breathing accelerating. Then a loud noise boomed from the other side. It was deep and buzzy. It sounded like a group of horns playing, but it wasn't melodic exactly. It was ominous, like a heralding. But then the sound transformed. It went from being an instrument to being a howl, climbing up a set of vocal cords. It was expelling itself, filling the space it was in. It twisted and turned, as though the sound was unfurling like a scroll, finding strange pitches. Then came another sound. Though he did not speak, she knew it came from Max. It started as a frantic yelping, like an animal freshly caught in a trap. Then the yelping sustained itself, climbed and crescendoed to a place Melanie had never heard a human voice reach. She was certain of it. She could sense his nerve endings frying with terror through the phone. He was talking in between screams, but it was too distorted to make out. There was a thud, a dragging across the floor. Max still pleaded and begged, but whatever was with him was clearly unmoved. The last thing she heard was something snuffling, snorting into the phone. Behind whatever it was, she could hear Max shrieking. The thing on the phone emitted a low growl, and then the phone cut out. And all at once, she felt herself splitting in half, right up the middle. Her ribcage broke and separated, and she felt everything rush from her. Regret, sadness, joy, pain, every emotion she had ever felt during her lifetime. All the people she had ever been tore from the tomb of her heart, finally released, finally free. She felt like ether then, like an element so light and high above everything. Like an element so light and high above everything, like something that could transcend beyond anything. One part of her died, and descended to the place beyond. And the version she was left with stayed suspended above it all, luminous, powerful, yet fragile. There was no more emotions to feel, just an understanding and a knowing of all of it.